Alright, let me do this. It's a fun little thing. From a, had a found a pretty cool free little library find.
Ooh.
Something I wouldn't really, I always see in bookstores, but I don't really like, it's like 30 bucks. Like, I'm not going to buy it. It was just sitting there in a free little library. So I was like, all right, let me pick it up. Hey, when's your birthday?
March
8th. March 8th. You always let it pass with like little fanfare, and I always feel guilty.
I know, I'm not, ever since
my birthday, I missed it.
Yeah, started in my 20s, I never really celebrated my birthday. Yeah, I think on my 21st birthday, I stayed in and studied for a Herman Melville Capstone course test. I think I got a C+ on that. I noticed you're looking through to find the date.
The book, yeah.
I'm not in there. No, interesting, March. Okay.
Oh, no, it's at the back. I was going and I went back. It's only back to like March 24th. I'm like, what is happening? Gotta go to the back of the book. For what? For Pisces. Okay. March 8th. Ooh. The day of nonconformity.
Mm. Day of nonconformity. That's all you have to tell me?
Yeah. Your strengths? Individual. Magnetic. Intuitive. And your weaknesses? Isolated. Emotionally difficult. Upsetting. I don't know if that's to yourself or to others.
Okay.
Famous people. Do you know, do you happen to know other famous people born on this day before I read them?
I did at one point. I always wanted to say Shaq was around the basketball player.
I can tell you, I'm not too impressed.
Not an impressive day. Huh.
Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes is probably the biggest guy.
Holmes, okay.
Kenneth Graham. Author of Wind in the Willows.
Okay.
Take that back. That's cool.
There's a lot of famous people over history. You know, if I'm getting Kenneth Graham as my most famous person, that's not exactly a rousing endorsement, I will say.
Hey, Kenneth Graham.
Yeah, I can.
Sid Charisse, old-timey singer, it looks like.
Okay, that's not helping the case.
Aidan Quinn.
Actor?
Yeah, from Legends of the Fall.
Okay.
Collins.
Probably on the same level as Kenneth Graham, maybe a little bit less.
Jim Rice.
Baseball Red player. Sox.
Yeah.
50 years ago. Okay.
Pete Crash Allen. Yeah, I mean, that's
about it. I mean, is this intro supposed to make me feel better? Or?
I didn't look. I forgot what your birthday was, so I didn't know. I didn't know what March 8th was.
That's fine. So.
But yeah, your Pisces, your.
All those strengths, I don't think are true.
So, you are an individual.
Well, that's a good point. The weaknesses might be true.
You're upsetting and isolated.
You know what that means.
I don't know if you're emotionally difficult, though. Pretty even-keeled.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
You're not flying off the handle.
I do get mad, though, sometimes. Keep it reeled in, though, Matt.
Those born on March 8th may be accident prone, particularly men born on this day. That's you.
Interesting. Yeah. Accident prone. Yeah. When do those show up? Knock on wood.
I don't know. Because March 8th people are sensitive and open to many forms of experience, they not infrequently get themselves in both physical and psychological trouble.
How does this book come about? How do these, I'm going to call them prophecies. I mean, is this from, I feel like this is from like the 1950s that this comes about.
I'm going to say, I don't know if they update them. No, I mean, astrology has been around forever.
Yeah, I think it feels like a 1950s. It's like, oh, you think astrology has been around for 4,000 years. No, it was actually created in the 1950s after the first McDonald's was built. You're like, oh, neat.
Like how Valentine's Day is a Hallmark marketing.
Yeah, astrology is something that's not as old. This is complete made of it. If you're really into astrology, you're probably turning off the podcast right now and leaving a negative review. But it's for me right now, after this, you know, not so glowing. I wonder if you could find a day that's just really, really a stellar birthday, man.
Well, let me see.
Can you see
May 30th. Oh, The Day of Nimble Time. That is a literary fiction book. The Day of Nimble Time. Strength. Yeah,
okay.
Strength. Quick. Expansive. Skillful.
Hmm.
Weaknesses. Oversensitive. Nervous. Unstable.
You don't strike me as a nervous person.
Well.
I'm a nervous person. What if we were swapped at birth and told the wrong days? Have you ever thought about that? Have you ever seen your birth certificate?
No.
Yeah, no one had.
If they used to put the babies in that little room overnight, and like, you know, in theory, you could like act, the nurses could accidentally switch babies.
Do you ever think it's happened that a nurse just writes the wrong day because they think it's the wrong day? You know, some people are like, oh, it feels like a Thursday.
Especially back before computerized records. Now it's all like in there. But yeah, back in the 80s when we were one. Let me see. So I got Peter the Great, which is pretty cool. Not you. It's a Russian.
I know that was.
Benny Goodman, Gail Sayers.
Interesting collection.
Yeah.
What if this is the like your this is the table you meet when you go to heaven, so to speak?
Oh, you get sorted by birthday?
Yeah, Benny Goodman.
That introductory dinner. Yeah. I could talk.
Most famous people that have been born on your birthday greet you and go welcome.
I got Mel Blanc, voice of Bugs Bunny, Winona Judd, Benny Goodman and Gail Sayers.
Pretty solid.
Great.
I think you beat me.
I can make chit chat with those guys.
And Gail.
Yeah. All right. Well, so, and the fun part of this was let me get this. I'll bring it downstairs and I'll look up Mithridates, Jupiter. I'll look up his birthday.
Yeah.
And we'll have some fun with that. But he's so ancient, nobody knows the exact day. They're not even real sure about the year.
Well,
it's 35 roughly, but some places say 136 BC, some places say 132. But the exact day, so we can't look up Mithridates in The Secret Language of Birthdays, which is the book that I've been reading from.
Are you going to nominate that for May?
We have to. Well, I could. I guess we just read everybody's birth. We go through 365 days.
Does the day change by, like, does the meaning of the day change by year?
No, I think it's a pretty, like.
Yeah, see, I don't see that. I think that book does.
Well, and it's all within the sign. They have, you know, the 12 signs. Like, you're Pisces, which is you're basically fish. I'm a Gemini, which means there's like two of me. And there's other, you know, whatever. I won't read it on air, but I'm going to look
at it. Yeah, I know. This is
kid stuff. But
I always thought with those ancient times, because the calendars have changed over time, right?
Yeah.
And I think in the Middle Ages, they just moved ahead or moved back in time because the calendar was all screwed up.
Well, because I wasn't sure. I was never sure if Peter the Great counted. Because he's born in May 3rd. Like, they switched from the Gregorian calendar to the Julius.
Yay.
Or vice versa. I actually don't know.
Yeah,
so there was, like, a period in the 1700s or 1800s where everything just moved forward 10 days. So I've always wondered how, like, okay, how do you do the astrology with
there
that?
There was a book once while we were at the bookstore working together, and it was talking about, like, calendars. And I was shocked by how much it changed over time.
Yeah?
Yeah. I'm going to look that up right here. Biggest change in calendars.
You mean physical layout? Like, instead of 31 blocks, they used to be circular or something?
No. I want to say, when was this?
How they kept time. Like, there used to be 300 days or something.
Yeah. Anyway.
We know the French Revolution, I think they tried to make to where there were 10 days.
So the Gregorian calendar skipped 10 days in October of 1582 in order to make up for the extra days that had been accrued under the Julian calendar.
Okay, so we're on the Gregorian calendar now.
That would be fun if you were in 1582 and they just skipped 10 days.
Yeah.
That would be fun.
You see, but that stuff, how much does that stuff matter? They were seasonal anyway, especially if you were a peasant or something. You know, you don't have a calendar, and like, you're not counting down the days till Christmas vacation. You're going with the seasonal harvest. your crops when they're ready.
Did you really, I mean, deal. Say 2,000 years ago, you must have really had to pay attention. Or did you even care?
I think you paid attention to the season. I don't think written calendar. But
did the average people care? Like, oh, this is this day. I don't think they did.
No, but they would have festival days, actually.
Good point.
But I don't know. Yeah, that's interesting. I always remember, like, time zones didn't really matter up until the railroads.
I was going to say the railroads changed everything. There used to be way more time zones in America.
There used to be, they used to not matter. You used to not need time zones because you wouldn't travel from the Atlantic to the Pacific. There would be no reason for the East and West Coast to be on the same time zone. Or to need the same time. That like little bit of couple hours wouldn't be a big deal until high speed rail travel. And then everybody's got to be kind of on the same. You couldn't conduct business across time zones is what I was fishing for. Does that make sense?
Yeah. We got birthdays, me and birthdays. We got time zones.
I just wanted to plug the secret birthday.
Calendars. I like that.
Which I just picked up for free. I just took it.
Now
I didn't even look anything on it. I was like, hey.
Was this one of our stores that the bookstores we go to where they have a free wall outside?
No, it wasn't that. It was a free little library. I was taking a kid.
I think you're supposed to give a book back to, though.
I will eventually. I didn't have any on me because I was pushing a stroller. Yeah. I would at some point.
You took that one. Was that the best?
I do. I go on one or two walks with the kids a day, so you know. I like saw it and I was like, I'm just gonna take that book.
And on that note, welcome to There Will Be Books, a podcast about books and calendars. I'm Peter, joined as always by Matt. Matt, I cut you off right there. What were you gonna say?
No, it's all right. I've got a couple other fun things. We can skip some throughout the,
I thought that was just, I didn't know you had more fun things. Before we started recording, you said, I got some fun things to talk about. I thought it was, birthday stuff and like that. This week's episode is going to be kind of a part one of a book that we nominated. Kind of a book that you kind of pushed for, and it sounded interesting to me at the end of last year. And that would be The Poison King by Adrian Mayer, a history book. I think this was back in November.
November's.
And you sold it. It kind of how we're doing this, we're breaking up. If you have the book, we're breaking it up to where, like all good history books, there's usually a part in the middle where there's pictures and kind of, glossy photos in the middle. That's where we stopped. We're going to discuss part one. Of the kind of the history and the story behind Mithridates, a figure I did not know anything about going in. Mm-hmm. And you kind of sold me on him on this sort of quasi, he was fascinated by poisons and he learned to become like a master of poisons, use them, be immune to certain point, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And so I went in with that sort of, okay, this is what. And the book and the story so far is so much more. And my first question to you is, I don't know, this is maybe jumping ahead a little bit. But for a history book to work for sort of people that aren't fans of certain time periods or people or events, I think history books can kind of work fairly easily. Like if you like for me, World War II books work fairly easy. Like, you don't have to do a lot of heavy lifting for me to enjoy the book, right? Before, I don't, this time frame, it's not something I'm drawn to, but this book works. And I was wondering, why does it work? Why does Adrian Mayer, the book succeed so far? And I kind of came up with a couple of things, but have you ever had a sense like you're reading on a subject you don't generally like, I don't seek this out. I don't watch movies about this. I don't listen to podcasts about this kind of like history. And for it to work, I think it's quite impressive. It's not so much like, oh, the poison's really interesting. It's like the whole time frame and how this author kind of tells the story and also like sets the scene and does a lot of like heavy lifting, I feel like, because for anyone familiar with this is, we're in BC times. You kind of have to like piece things together. Not all the history records are upkept. Like it's, some periods of our kind of our quote unquote hero. It's not really a hero, I would say, but hero story is, you know, lost to time. So the author, it's a, the high difficulty thing to do. And I've been very impressed so far, Matt. I just want to state that out from the beginning.
Good. Yeah. No, I think she's a good writer, good historian, and she's got a lot of the subject matter is fascinating. It's one of the most fascinating people I've ever read about. And it's kind of, he's kind of fallen off. I get this, in the past, he was kind of more well-known, more part of culture. You know, like Western culture. Mozart wrote an opera entitled Mithridates. Hausmann wrote a poem. There's a pretty famous line, "He died old." It's, yeah, he's a little part in a Hausmann poem. And yeah, but he's kind of fallen off. And he's one of the most fascinating people. And it's a really interesting time. It's right before Rome became an empire. And he was kind of like a big, Rome wound up winning, but he was a big,
considered the, like, the biggest threat to Rome right before.
Yeah, after Hannibal. Mithridates, right before they came, like we're talking 135 BC to about 60, the 60s BC.
And the book, I think, starts off in an interesting place. It's before, it doesn't start like in the, it's not like it begins with his childhood. It begins with an event I don't think many people know about. And it's kind of shocking. It's the sort of this plot, this murderous plot by Mithridates to like kill all the Romans in the Anatolia region, right?
Which is basically Turkey.
Turkey.
And it's, yeah.
And it's like this very successful, and there's like some dispute, but it's between, what is it, 80 to 150,000 people they say were killed.
It, Roman.
It's very like shocking.
Yeah. Yeah.
That huge. Occurs.
Yeah. A couple things there. It kind of, it was, how do you carry something like that out? Especially back then, what happened is it was basically Anatolian people were colonized by Rome, and one of the things this book kind of drives home is just how brutal Rome was. You know, I think a lot of us in the West and, you know, England and America, we see the dramas where British people in togas and like gladiator and whatever, and they're all speaking in British accents, and it's very like Julius Caesar the play. You know, it's kind of very noble, and there was that element of it, but also their overseas empire, they were brutal people. They would just invade a country, suck them, like just bleed them dry through taxes. So they were very resented. And in 88 BC in Anatolia, the Anatolian, the people who were colonized by Rome, one day it was just on an agreed upon signal. They rose up and they just killed anywhere from 80 to 150,000 Roman people.
And my first thing, and this struck me throughout the book, and I think you kind of touched on it, was how were things like communicated and planned back then?
What?
That's always like staggering that like all these big events happen.
Yeah.
But I think in our sort of modern sensibilities, we have to be like, there was a lot more time and like maybe like two big events would happen in 10 years because it took time to like get people places and for ideas to spread and for people to kind of be like, I don't know. It struck me while reading this, you know, first part of this book was just like, how was information like communicated? How were things planned? How was, Mithridates had like he's very like, he has spies in Rome. So he's up to date on like the goings on in Rome. And so that's a key thing that he uses for his advantage as he kind of progresses and gains power. But I was like, that's an impressive feat at that time, right?
Well, sure. Things move a little slower. War and espionage, you have to communicate through notes or horse.
Yeah.
Horse courier. As a side note, the book, she doesn't mention it in this one, but the book I read on Alexander the Great, a couple years ago, I mentioned it on the podcast. Actors, traveling troops of actors, were oftentimes used as couriers of information, maybe even spies, because they're all over the place.
Okay.
And so they put on a show, and then the local prince or wherever you're at would maybe come and talk to, you know, one of the actors and just say, hey, when you're in Thebes, why don't you go ahead and communicate to the prince or king or whatever, you know what I mean? So things move a little slower. But with this specific event specifically, like, how do you get that many people in on it? Enough people to participate willingly to stab to death all the Romans in your city, but to keep it quiet to where the Romans aren't suspicious at all. Like, how does that work? That's amazing. I think Adrian Mayer says, like, it's baffling to historians now, because it definitely happened. Mm-hmm. And it obviously was communicated to only the Anatolians, and the Romans weren't any the wiser. Like, if you were putting that, if this hadn't happened, you're just putting that into, like, your novel that you're working on, an editor would be like, oh, yeah, this doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
There's no way you keep it quiet. There's like 10 different things, like, good idea, but it's really implausible. But it historically happened. So, I mean, that's a good, like, this after all the introductory, like, historical notes and stuff, it, like, opens with, okay, here's kind of, this and is the biggest of it, the, like, the most gray area of the guy's life.
Well, I think that a key thing is that she kind of highlights the contradictions of him, right? Because after that, you're like, oh, is this guy's gonna just going to be, it's going to be a bad versus bad or evil versus evil. Like, that this doesn't sound good. But then, you come to learn that, what is it? Early, it's also, I think, in the first chapter, he pardoned prisoners of war. He granted wide democratic voting rights. This is all in the 1380s. And he sort of had these noble ideas. Well, also, he did this sort of murderous plot. So I liked, for me, as, like, someone who didn't know anything going into this book, and sort of in my very, I thought this was just going to be about his, like, love of poison. And that's there, right? Like, he is fascinated by, he, like, used poison as a very, like, important thing to know about at this time. If you're an important person, like, people are trying to kill you all the time. Doesn't his father die of poison? His
father got poisoned probably by his mother. That's a key aspect of his personality, right? Yeah. He essentially made himself immune to a lot of the common poisons by dosing himself in small doses over time. So
as someone who does, I liked the sort of, okay, we have a complicated figure here, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you learn he has sort of these, he has this sort of, like, these prophecies around his birth and sort of his rise to power, right?
There's a
an element of, like, okay, this is bigger. Like, there's something bigger here in the story, Grant, whether it's true or not, but people believe that he had a calling, so to speak.
Oh, sure. Well, and then it's one of those things that sounds mythological and fake. And, you're reading it now. Skeptical Western eye and be like, oh, that's obviously added later, but historical fact. So there was a prophesized a king would come from the east to defeat the mighty empire, which is Rome. And once again, can't stress how, like, hated Rome was by people outside of Rome. But the year Mithridates was born, there's a gigantic comet that stayed in the sky for, like, what, months? And it's just a huge ball with, like, a tail, like, as big as the sky, just a huge comet, appeared out of nowhere the year he was born. And then there's another gigantic comet about the year he becomes king in 118-ish BC. And so, whether or not you're, like with the birthday book, do you believe in that stuff? Or the guy in the 1380s?
Things start to line up in a way that was at least his story becomes more remembered, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, and these comets happen. So if you believe in the prophecy and all that woo stuff, he fulfills the prophecy, or at the very least, the guy was astute enough to take advantage of the legend. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And
to tie into sort of, like, okay, let's build him up even more, right?
Yeah.
And I wasn't quite sure if this was, like, fact or if this was just sort of, like, my mom says this, or my parents say this is true. His family is tied to Alexander the Great too, right? And he does come in possession of one of his robes.
Of his purple cloak.
Purple cloak, right?
It's only a couple hundred years after Alexander, so
it's
halfway plausible.
Yeah.
So you add that into it. So now we're okay. So now we're a lot of different elements are at play as far as like as a fan of like history and learning about stuff. There's a lot of interesting things that she's putting on the table early, right? To get me hooked, so to speak. Even if I'm not like, I don't, some of the side characters, some of the like historians, some of the, I still at this time, like I, some of the names, they name their kids all like the same name sometimes, or like, he marries his sister, and then he kills his sister. Like all this sort of stuff is, it kind of be hard to make a family tree out of easily, I would say.
Sure.
But I don't think she gets bogged down in that, and it's nothing's that confusing. So I think the beginning of this book does a great job of setting the scene. Why is this story important? You're like, okay, this is, I can understand why. And then you're also wondering, oh man, that's like almost a lost story to history. Like, cause like you said, he's not as famous as he like seemingly should be. Like he
should be and used to be.
And used to be.
This is like, I would call him my personal like favorite historical character.
Mm-hmm.
He's the most fascinating by far. Most of the stuff that survives written about him is written by his enemies. And the Romans had a grudging respect for him, but a lot of the primary stuff was lost. And like with Alexander the Great, actually, we have secondary sources like written based on the primary sources, but the primary sources are kind of gone. But you can kind of piece together what was going on.
And she says that, or like clearly, like this part, like, we're going to have to like think like what would be expected. Like,
yeah.
What would someone of his age and like his like stature do like as a young man? I like the part where we kind of the story goes back. So how did, you know, she kind of brings like, how did he get to sort of become, you know, king or ruler of this time, and goes through the story of like, he and his friends go off because they're afraid that they might be poisoned or killed or
whatever. I wanted to kind of dwell on that.
Okay.
That's just the trail of his life up to this is kind of worth going into. That's okay. Why I always want to do two-parters with this historical stuff, because I just want to geek out on the history.
Oh yeah, I want to let you geek out.
But yeah, no, it's a good tale. That's part of what makes it such a good, and she knows kind of what's important, what's going to move you along. So we get the first chapter is about the massacre, and then we go back to, there's a lot of time on the comets when he's born, you know, the child who's prophesied.
Some of that scene in like coins and stuff at the time, and that they can piece that together, that does hold significance.
Really worth comment.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. And so he's born into this, you know, there's a little, the kingdom of Pontus on the Black Sea.
Mm-hmm.
This little kingdom. His dad's the king. He grows up in the palace. His dad gets poisoned, and his mom has a favorite son, and he's like, she doesn't want him to be king. And so these weird little accidents keep happening, and he kind of pieces together, like, I think she's trying to kill me. Mm-hmm. And so he, when he's maybe 14-ish years old, he and his friends, like, you make an elaborate show, like, hey, we're going on a hunting trip, but their real purpose is to just go into the woods, get clear of all that, learn the lay of the land, make connections, and bide your time until you're an adult and you can come back and become king. And also his mother, there's a big, like, Rome is the big empire, and there are kings and people of power in Anatolia, which is basically is Turkey nowadays. But there are people back then who wanted to fight Rome, and there are Quislings who make alliance with Rome, and then they get, you know, you get paid off as the king or queen, and then your people get like taxed to death, but you know, you're just you're a pliant pawn, basically. And that was Mithridates' mom. She made an alliance with Rome and just lived a life of luxury at the expense of all her people. And Mithridates and his friends are all out in the woods. And this is one of the speculations, but he is probably learning all about toxicology and poisons and starting his little process of making himself immune to arsenic and whatever. Going around to all the castles and important people, making connections, kind of having dinner.
He's shaking hands, kissing babies.
He's shaking hands, kissing babies. Like, hey, if I were to come and mother, would you back me? Right? And he's in the anywhere from 3 to 4 to 7 years. Oh, and if all this stuff sounds like a fairy tale, it kind of is like a lot of this stuff. There's an interesting footnote. Actually, I read the footnotes this time through. And she points out a lot of this stuff you want to dismiss as like fairy tale tropes, but there's a really good chance that a lot of the Western and European fairy tale tropes come from this story.
Oh, really?
Because there are a lot of big operas and everything about Mithridates back in the day. And so kind of flip it around and be like, oh, that's a trope. And maybe consider like, oh, this might be where a lot of those tropes come from. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, so anyway, so going to the woods for 7 years and then coming back, reclaiming the kingdom. He deposes, he marries his sister, imprisons his mother. And then, but she dies.
Yeah.
Like, you can't like put her to death publicly. But oh, another fairy tale trope. His two other sisters, he has them like locked away in a tower for the rest of their lives so they can't produce a threat. That's a very big fairy tale trope, right? The princess is locked in the tower. Comes back, becomes king, and then starts like consolidating, building a little kingdom/empire on the Black Sea with the goal of eventually fighting Rome and pushing them back, you know, to Greece and keeping them as far west as he can.
Mm-hmm. No, you make a good point, because a lot of this story so far is, oh, this would make for great, this is great storytelling, A, and B, adaptation wise, there's so much meat on the bone here, right?
There's a ton there. And yeah. And
I like,
okay, that probably didn't happen. There's actually the comets happened. You know, he did disappear into the woods for a bit and then come back.
He's set up. He's. I think it says in the book, he's like, he's put in the perfect position to, like, Rome is, people hate Rome. So he can pose this as sort of, I think the term is, he is like on the side of truth and light. And that is on the side of against Rome. He's at this sort of east meets west kind of border, like imaginary border, so to speak. He has this sort of Persian noble education. I like this ride, shoot, and tell the truth. It's sort of the three things. And then he has the skill of bringing people together, but he's very shrewd politician, so to speak, at the beginning, before he becomes sort of a military person. He has to, which I thought was interesting, like when the first battle happens, and that's sort of like where we kind of take a break in the book. It's like his first battle, like he has everything leading up to this is very much in the sort of political sphere, or gaining the trust of, you know, nomad groups or whatever, or kind of reading the tea leaves, or how would you phrase, like he does all the sort of the I don't know, he's not this warrior from the beginning, right? Although he probably knows how to do it,
probably capable
stuff.
Of it,
but
yeah.
That's not his like starting point. That's not where like he's 20 and he's, you know, fighting battles.
He does
some shrewd things, like he brings back the chariot, right, with the blades. We're like kind of.
That's how he won his first battle. Yeah, with Scythe the chariots. You know, you're right. He's more of a politician, kind of a natural, just making the right alliances. He subdued. There's on the other side of the blood in the north part of the Black Sea. There's some like tribes, like Scythian tribes, and he subdues them, but not quite brutally enough to where like they're just allies, and they'll come in handy like later in his life. Like piracy is big in the Black Sea. He kind of makes alliances with pirates to kind of counteract.
He has a lot of money, which he points out that there no one's really quite sure how he has this much money.
It's like the Count of Monte Cristo. He's always got plenty of money,
so he's able to not plunder the people that he sort of convinces.
He can be popular because he doesn't have to raise taxes. But it's like, okay, so how does he have, he's not taxing his people to death. How does he have all his money? He just kind of always
has money.
It's it's like fairy tale-ish. It's like, how did,
you're the kind of Monte Cristo.
He's friends with pirates. And the tribes, you can like call on all these magical friends to come help him.
Information is power, obviously. Like he has that, I think that's a key thing in his rise. Like he has very good spies and he has.
And that's what he was doing out in the wood. Like he's making connections.
And
It's
he, at the beginning of sort of his in conflict of Rome, he does some like he gets sort of Rome to commit to fight him, but also makes them look like the aggressor in a way, which is very. I
It's a
thought
kind
it.
of complex political situation with Rome there, because he's officially like a friend of Rome, because it is kind of the political situation, but he kind of knows he wants to push back, but he like baits Rome into attacking first, and so he can be the good guy and make a final push to push him back. And he basically wants to get him like back to Greece and kind of have the Anatolian border be as far east as they go, and he's going to be the king slash emperor, of the East.
A good friend Xenophon is or Xenophon is mentioned a couple times in this,
They
so he
went. They were in the air. They're in
territory.
Mithridatic territory.
I like that part of the book. I was thinking, hey,
Stuff with the honey and the poison,
yeah.
the honey from the rhododendrons that makes you sluggish and slow.
What else do we have here? I don't know. It's just there's so many elements to this story where I was reading as I'm excited to read the second half, definitely, but I was like, this is. I didn't read the footnote where you're like, oh, a lot of these tropes are maybe have started from here. That makes so much sense because I'm like, I was amazed by how much of the story was like, it was just great story. Like, oh, I couldn't believe that all these things were like lining up and like how he was doing things and hit, how events unfolded. I was like, this is incredible. So I was shocked that I didn't know this story or this story wasn't more well known. I
I
guess
know
so
that's
far.
not.
Like, I don't know how, like,
This
obviously, it'll end in part two or whatever, but just the lead up to this, it seems like such a, like, oh, there's a lot of things that people can hook on to and is engaging, right?
fascinating, yeah.
Far as
Oh,
history, right?
and we kind of buried the big one for our culture at this time. He got struck by lightning as a baby and has a lightning scar on his head. Like that's, you want to talk about like fairy tale trope, is like that's,
That seems like that might be.
well, still it was a legend
Yeah.
about him. And then 1997 years later, the most popular book of our time is written where a kid has a
Do
light
you
star.
think that Mithridates was inspired by?
Very
That
curious.
sounds like one of those things that you would like to be like, you know what? Actually, Harry Potter was inspired
Well,
by
I would be
Mithridates.
genuinely curious if she had heard the story, or it just happens to be one of those tropes she's familiar with. I don't know.
Which she doesn't know the origin of, but it maybe has started with.
It's cool, yeah. Your hero has to be marked out specially, right? So that's right. There's a part, you haven't seen the movie, but in The Princess Bride, there's a part where the person has made himself immune to poison. I'm curious if William Goldman had heard of Mithridates at this point or not, but there's also what is about to happen to the Aquilas guy in the next chapter was used in Game of Thrones.
Okay. I was
It's
so coming to this with not a lot of background knowledge of the time. I was kind of surprised that like he goads these Roman generals sort of to fight without the consent of the Senate. Am I saying that
Yeah, in
correctly?
theory, the Senate has to authorize the war, but Rome, there's a civil war going on in Rome, Marius versus Sulla,
Yeah.
and there's rebellion in the boot part of Italy, and so it's a good time to kind of push back
To
because
push back. Yeah, I enjoyed that part and sort of the history behind or the dynamics behind that, I guess. It's not like Rome's not sort of, it doesn't seem like Rome's a unified identity, right?
not
At
as much as they
this
were, and not
time.
as much as they will be.
Yes.
Because right before, I think Julius, when Mithridates is an old man about to die, Julius Caesar's a young kid. I
Okay.
think that's kind of the time. Like Pompey is alive at the time, so it's like a generation or two before Caesar's,
Okay.
before they officially became an empire. But it's a good, like the Aquilas, the guy kind of screwed up and went to war too soon against Mithridates. His father was a governor or whatever the term is, the guy in charge of the Anatolian province in Rome. And rather than like fight, he had to take back territory after the Anatolians rebelled. And he, instead of like sieging the city and fighting this big old campaign, he poisoned the water supply and just killed a bunch of people in the cities so he could just take back power quick. So it's like, we're dealing with like very brutal tactics. And that's why Rome's hated and why it's plausible.
And why that Mithridates comes up with this plan to kill that hundred thousand.
And why everybody goes along with it, right?
Yeah.
Because it's not.
It wouldn't work if it was just
the army coming through and killing the Romans. It was other citizens.
Yeah, yeah.
The populace. So, and then also in this book, she talks about how slaves in Rome, like so you could tell they were slaves, they would carve on your forehead, like, I'm a slave. Or if you were a runaway, they would carve in Latin, I am a runaway, like into your forehead. So like, and that's something you miss in, you know, watch movies about Roman stuff. There's never people with, I am a, you know.
Yeah.
I guess a lot of people wore bandanas, pirate style, to hide the scars in their forehead. So it's like Rome, they were very, very brutal people.
In sort of the culture of where Mithridates comes from, to be in debt, which Rome is basically, that's their whole goal, is to keep people in debt to them. It's like this very dishonorable thing. So I think that spurs the populace into...
nobody likes being...
Yeah, I mean, no one likes that, but it seemed to take... She kind of seemed to make a point of it to be like, it was like, especially...
They would intentionally put these kingdoms into debt so they would owe Rome.
Yeah.
And they would pick a chosen monarch and then let them live in luxury, but the population is impoverished. That system of government hasn't gone, by the way, it hasn't gone. It's still used for it. This day and age.
So I enjoyed, I don't know, you learn Mithridates, you have to learn settings. I'm surprised I'm not that lost with anything so far, which I think speaks to how good of a writer and storyteller Adrian Mayer is. I know this book was a finalist for the National Book Award. And this came out 2010. So it's a relatively new book. Is this the... I didn't look. Do you know of any other like modern histories of Mithridates?
I believe I have all. There's three.
Okay.
There's like a couple of French things, and excluding like the old French plays and Mozart's opera and all that. And then like he's in Plutarch and some of the old Roman historians. But as far as modern English, there is a book called, I'm blanking on it. A book by Michael Curtis Ford, which is actually, I read that. And then this came out and I snatched this, The Poison King, up. And there's one called He Died Old by Alfred Duggan from the 50s or 60s.
Okay.
And that's there's three. There's three things.
The challenge too with a story like this, and we've touched on this a couple of times, it's just getting the sourcing. This actually inspired me to like look up forgotten books. Because a lot of this, like so many like histories or stories or plays are just gone. Like the reference, but you have no idea what they're about, which I think is fascinating. I think it's something that we could look into later on in the podcast. Just like talk about, you know, there's a Shakespeare play, Homer as a, I think it's his first.
Well, I read somewhere that the Iliad and the Odyssey are two of like a 7 or 8 part thing that he wrote. And we only have two.
The one I saw, I can't remember the title, but I was like, I never heard of this before, but there's a host of this. And especially at the time frame, it's like,
what's his face?
Get a fraction of the stuff.
The Greek playwright. The turtle dropped on his head. Why am I blanking on his name? Aeschylus. I don't know how to say it.
Yeah, some of the names.
Bald one who's the turtle dropped on his head. Supposedly he had like 50, and we only have a handful.
I mean, it's just a fraction. So I think that might be a reason why we don't have more books about this, is how much can you really uncover?
In English, no.
In English, yeah.
He's kind of dropped off. He was don't know. Yeah, there's older source. He's in Plutarch, but as an he's because you know Plutarch like broke him up by his chapters were all people. So he's in Pompey's chapter and Marius's chapter and all that. But
what was I gonna say here? No, definitely seems like something like for modern readers, audiences, they could like, this story would be a hit with people, but also like adapting it for a movie or maybe we can get to that in the second part. But just I don't know. This seemed like storytelling 101. Like all the ingredients are there.
I would love something to be made. I don't know if I necessarily trust a streaming service right now to make it.
But I mean, it's almost there. Like the scope is too big, but just
a mini series.
There's so much intrigue.
It's
at this time.
Yeah.
I know they made the show Rome, right?
Oh, you could totally do it. It's sneaking on a lot of people. It'd be great. It's perfect. It's like laid out for you, the mythic structure. It's fascinating.
Give me some more nerdy stuff that you had there.
All right. I like the concept of ostension.
Okay.
O-S-T-N-S-I-O-N. It's when your actions in real life are guided by myths and legends. Something a lot of great people do. Like Alexander the Great did that with Achilles. Like consciously would go out of his way to reenact. He carried a copy of the Iliad around, like slept with it under his pillow. And he would intentionally do things that Achilles did in the Iliad, you know. And Mithridates did that with Alexander intentionally. I think Julius Caesar kind of did it with Alexander. Napoleon did it with Caesar and Alexander. So I like that. I didn't know there's a word for it. But the concept of basing your actions on myth and legend and then becoming reality. Yeah,
I mean that must be pretty like fulfilling to pull it off, because I imagine that you know there must be examples where that you were like, oh, I'm going to do this for him, and it doesn't work out.
Sure, but you don't write books about those people.
You don't write books about those people.
But it is kind of it becomes like a self fulfilling prophecy. Like yeah. Great, just knew beyond a doubt he was going to conquer the world, and he went out and.
There's something about these prophecies when they happen, like. You know, 2,000 years ago, where I'm like fascinated. But if it was like right now, I'd be like, I don't really have time for someone to be like, I'm actually destined. You know, that solar eclipse that happened, that is actually the signal too. I guess at the time, more people, it was more widely believed. I don't know.
Well, I wonder. See, I think that's like the trick, right?
Yeah.
Is to know beyond a shadow of a doubt that like you're going to do this. Because there's all sorts of, there's any doubt.
Yeah.
It's just like, okay, no, I'm going to do it. This is my path in life. And you read a lot of people, like George Washington supposedly was very calm in battle as bullets were whizzing by. There's something about the notion of just like knowing, hey, if I die, I die, but this is what I'm here to do. Like, and so that is kind of.
I guess maybe all the prophecy stuff, it's like a cherry on top because he actually went ahead and like accomplished the things that are tied to sort of story.
True. And ostension is different than prophecy.
Yeah.
And there's both of these, but ostension is just the idea of basing your actions off myth and legend. And your actions tend to become mythological and legendary because you were basing it on myth and legend, right? That sort of cycle or process. And then prophecy is this whole other thing, which I don't know. And I don't know if people, there's a whole little online thing, and I think it's half ironic, but people are like mythologized the Roman Empire. Like think about, you know, men think about the Roman Empire every day and all that stuff. So I don't know. There's like a longing for it. I mean, nobody acts or does anything. It's all like online weird stuff.
Yeah.
But
I think this time frame is hard to kind of grasp in a way. Just it's so long ago and there's just huge gaps in history that we have no reference point for. Like if I was to say, like, how was life in 800? You'd be like, in my head, it'd be like, is it kind of like it was 800 years before? You know what I mean? There's
the
advances are sort of ebb and flow, where it's hard to, for me at least, to get a, like I'm surprised by things, and then I'm like, just, Like I said at the kind of beginning, I'm surprised that just how like information gets around. Because in
Sure.
my mind, I'm like,
Well,
these are big expanses of land. It's hard to like walk from here to here or take a horse from here to here or get on a boat that might sink and go from here to here. And the message might, burn in a fire. And then, not everyone speaks the same language and we can't communicate together. And how is this all happening? Like, if I was to tell you, hey, we're going to meet 60 miles that way, there's a good chance we would not find that if we didn't have X, Y, and Z.
well, sure. Well,
But I mean, they had different skills. They could like they had, different talents that have been
they
lost.
made it work. It worked slower, but there was sort of.
But that's still kind of an impressive thing, right?
Sure.
Okay.
And I should say, like, the Dark Ages in Europe, there's less information. There's actually a ton of information that survived from Rome. But Mithridates and people, there are gaps because a lot of the stuff got lost, and Mithridates was the enemy of Rome. So not a lot of stuff survived. But you could find the plenty of stuff about Rome. But as civilizations rise and fall, Library of Alexandria got burned. Probably
That's
lost a lot
good.
of stuff there.
Any more nerdy stuff, Matt? Give me some more nerdy stuff.
Let's see. I like the we mentioned Mithridates came into possession of Alexander's cloak, which was a big deal. People believed it like conferred power and stuff. It is the origins of the term to assume the mantle or have power vested in you. It literally, you wore the cloak of someone great and you became powerful like them. The origins of those terms, that's cool, right?
That's very cool.
Vested power because you wear their vest. Maybe think of remember in Wonder Boys,
Oh,
the
yeah, the professor.
kid, Tobey Maguire's fascinated by Marilyn Monroe's jacket. People buy what people would like pay top dollar for Elvis's leather, whatever. You know what I mean? Like people still you associate power and prestige with the clothes of famous people. People wear jerseys. People wear a Patrick Mahomes jersey.
Good. Yeah.
Anyway.
Got me thinking. You got me thinking.
People back then knew how, like the people who were really into poison knew how to turn viper's venom back into medicine, which was something I guess we quote unquote just figured out how to do in modern science. But people who were into it back then
Yeah,
also
the
knew.
poison aspect of his story is just kind of a fun wrinkle. I thought it would be like the lead story. Part one for me going into this, but it wasn't the lead story for me.
It's part of like 10 different things.
Yeah, it's
It
part of
was
it's one of a
immune
dozen
to
things that I found
poison
fascinating.
with, who somehow we haven't gotten to it yet. Like we're at, in like trilogies, the second movie is usually the darkest where bad things happen. We left off like it's a, he's like at a high point and then things kind
Okay.
of, but he's
Which,
kind
because we're
of
leaving
on
off on a victory, right?
the boat. Yeah, and he's about to go to Rhodes, the island of Rhodes, and then
I
like
would
push, he's
think at
about to
this
push Rome
time,
back into Italy, right? He's
if you
gonna
go to
win.
an island, that's got to be dangerous. So you got to get off the island at some point, right? Continue on. It's just a
And
logistical nightmare, it feels
it's
like.
the civilized island. I think, Sicily is like an island. Anyway, I think you're overthinking this stuff.
I get in the weeds with this stuff. I'm always fascinated by like the operations of this, of how to move 40,000 people at that time.
Well, you can, I
I
mean, you
still
can do
felt the
it.
same way about Xenophon. Like all this, how do you move this many people?
You
Without
talk,
like
you got to
supply
pass
trucks.
orders. Word of mouth. Word of mouth.
Hey, the cavalry's coming through.
I won't go on like a Marshall McLuhan like rabbit hole thing, but I'll just say when he talks about like words and writing being a technology, in the history of the evolution of civilization, they actually are. Because you can't like in the evolution of like kingdoms and city states, you can't have a kingdom more than a city or two without language and then like written the having your orders written down and carried on a horse. Does that make sense? So you don't think of like letters as a technology, but it actually is a technology that allows kingdoms and empires to expand because of how you communicate. You can't hold further than a city if you don't have a piece of paper and written orders and a guy and a horse to go to the next city that you're going to conquer, because you can't rule that city without. whatever. It's a whole thing we could.
Yeah. Touched on it briefly, but the battle with the chariots, it seemed to be like a very memorable thing just by the carnage that occurred when the chariots came through and just seemingly like dismembered large.
Not seemingly. Spots.
They did. And it's
you hear my
it
note?
Still remembered in like, I can't remember who the historian was who wrote about it, but it was like, it's very like memorable, you know.
He was a child who grew up around like veterans of that war who like heard stories. Like, yeah, they just, well, so my note from the chariot battle is like, chariot charges were no joke.
No, they were not. And it was just kind of a tactical genius because they kind of had fallen out of favor in a way.
It used to happen all the time.
Yeah.
And Alexander the Great was fighting Darius, the Persian king, and the Persians had these scythe chariots. And it was like, well, they didn't fear Alexander. Like, we'll just run through the Macedonians. But Alexander had his men trained to, at the last minute, step aside, let him pass. And then before the horses could turn around, his men would come and hack the driver.
I think how terrifying that would be.
They'd hack the driver.
Hey, we got to move. And then you're like, you're just pushing. You're like in a
just hold.
You're like, God.
But so that tactic, letting him pass and then falling on the drivers from behind.
And then you shoot him in the back, right? You shoot him in the back.
You don't have to deal with the size, right? Because we're talking like what, 3 or 4 feet blades off the wheels of
that
like
turn as the wheel turns, right?
Yeah. So like really dangerous.
Sounds sharp. Oh, yeah.
But anyway, so the chariot, that's 200 years of the chariots not being, it's like, okay, that's an old technology.
Yeah. So this was, yeah, this all happened like
no one.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was Alexander the Great's time. Yeah. So 200 years later, no one was expecting it. So Mithridates turned around and used chariots against Rome. And the first time around, at least, it really worked.
Yeah, first time. That's
it. Blew through them. Yeah.
So.
No joke, though. Scary stuff.
That was my.
I was thinking how scary an old-time battle like that would be. Any battle now would be scary.
Yeah.
But I'm saying, like, just you're a guy with a sword and a shield, and then there's 40,000 people on the other side who are looking to kill you. Just how terrifying that would be.
Just the, I don't think you can imagine the sound, the smell.
You smell disgusting.
The
probably sweaty.
There's no like, I would imagine there's no like, I call for a medic and then I get quick medical attention. No, that's not that.
You're riding around all day and night.
I get injured. I probably get an infection, and that I'm probably gonna die from that.
If you're lucky, the medic comes along and puts maggots on your leg.
No, it's a bleak prospect. It's not.
I remember hearing, you know, like supposedly the berserkers the Gauls or in the Germanic tribes would like snort gunpowder. Or like all these amphetamine, not literally amphetamines, but these, to like pump them up for battle. And I remember hearing that and being like, yeah, man, do something. You gotta
do something.
Not going into this stone cold sober.
Like, I'll have my tea and then I will eat some bread and then I will throw a spear at this man.
You're not saying no thank you if you got battle the next thing. You want to snort some gunpowder? Yeah.
It's bad for my health. You'll probably die pretty.
Give me what you got. I don't want to.
It's kind of amazing. I don't know. Just sort of like these battles. You would think like population would just stall out. How much is like fighting would go on? She'd be like, "Oh, we just lost a lot of people. You know, we just lost 100,000 people to." I don't know. Yeah. It's the kind of things I ponder while I read old ancient history books. I think about operations, and I think about I'm kind of surprised populations didn't just stall out after some of these battles. Yeah. Anyway.
One more thing.
Okay.
I always think like this would be, you know, if you could magically transport back to a certain time and observe, like, I think I'd want to go see this era.
Good question.
But kind of what we were just talking about, you would, the wizard or whoever's taking you back there, you would have to specify. I just want to kind of hover. I don't want to be frontline troop. I don't want to be like, I want to speak the language. I just want to kind of be in his, I want to be in Mithridates' crew. I just want to observe. I don't want to be, I just want to, you know, that's who I'd want to see. Because if you're not careful, the wizard comes along and is like, I could take you to any point in time and you can you're like, let me see Alexander the Great. Let me see Mithridates. And then he snaps his fingers, but it's like a monkey's paw or an O. Henry story where you're like on the front lines. Like, no, no, no. I wanted to see the big, I didn't want to. And you don't, you only speak English. And there's like big rough dudes and you're in cargo shorts with like a big gulp. And you're like, feel really out of place.
You know what I think the thing that would probably hit you in this ridiculous scenario, it's probably not as cinematic as you would think it is. It's probably more dragged out and awful.
If you're on the front line, sure.
No, the whole thing, I feel like. The whole thing is just dragged out.
That's the thing with life. We talked about it last episode with Ripley and how they showed Rome not being crowded. When you imagine or nostalgize a place in your head, you imagine like, oh, it'd be nice to go to Italy on vacation.
Yeah.
Imagining just you and your wife and maybe the waiter serving you espresso. Yeah. You're not imagining 100 other tourists in the same cafe. You know what I mean? So when you nostalgia, like, oh, I'd like to go back and see the old West or whatever. Mm-hmm. You're still you and you're up against it in life. You don't know what's going to happen the next minute. So like any era, you know, you're still you, you're still in it. It still seems like life. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Like, oh, in real life, yeah, sure. You'd be, I think it'd be cool to see. This would be my era to
if
go.
If you could do one thing, all right. You can only do one thing and it would probably alter their lives, right?
Mm.
I picked my thing out that I would probably tell them to do.
All right, you go.
Because you're coming from history, like you're like, hey, you should probably do that's not good.
Okay,
my
so
thing
you can
would
go
be
back
like,
in time and do.
I would tell them they should probably wash their hands.
Okay. It might just murder you with sticks. Like, where are you going back to cavemen? Like, hey guys, wash your hands.
No, they didn't wash. They didn't know what the, you know.
I know. I'm just saying,
hands.
Who are you telling this?
I'm telling Mithridates. Wash your hands.
Are you telling? Oh, you're going to tell Mithridates? I'm getting a little ahead of myself. I would tell Mithridates, hey, when you're at this theater performance in Rhodes and you're going to bring the winged statue of Nike, the goddess of victory, check the ropes. Make sure they're solid.
That's a little...
Because the statue falls.
Preview next time we talk about
that. But. I try to make it to where he wins in Beach Run.
No, they didn't know water carried, you know, diseases in clean water. That wasn't a thing.
They knew more than, I mean, I think they knew more than we give them credit for.
I don't know.
Man made himself immune to poison. They did have basic.
True.
Hygiene.
They probably weren't
now,
the populace, otherwise. I don't know.
The peasants maybe didn't, but I think the aristocracy, the people, like they did have basic hygiene.
Okay.
They didn't have hand soap.
Yeah. It's one of those things where we might have evolved. Evolved with like health things, and then sort
sick.
Of got it right in a
sick.
way.
It's not a line. It's a
it's true. True. Thing. My apologies.
Yeah.
I won't tell Mithridates to wash his hands.
He's probably hysteria.
It's like with what? I'd be like, you know,
they had hygiene. You know, they
no,
knew
it's so.
Watch. They had hygiene.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've just read books about like. How did certain diseases wrap? And they were like, I don't know. I think it goes through the air. And it's like, no, we're drinking all this bad water. And this was like 200 years ago.
Sure.
So anyway. Any final notes, thoughts?
I think
think how about this? Leave me with what should I be on the lookout on part two of the book?
Well,
I'm imagining some things don't go his way for the rest of the
some
book.
Ups and downs.
Some ups and downs. Okay.
You know, Aquilus, the Roman bad guy, may have molten gold like pouring down his throat.
Okay.
Kind of a
not good.
Evil, but he kind of had
it coming. It's true.
And then like a big ominous thing. Speaking of signs and portents, a big ominous thing happens, and then the siege of Rhodes doesn't go quite as well, and he loses battles, but he always like Bugs Bunny. Keeps coming back, like, you know, like he gets beat, he doesn't quite, you know, but he always comes back. He just keeps coming back, and he lives to be an old man.
Okay.
And his death scenes vary. There's a lot to delve into. There's a lot more history to geek out on. There's a have you heard of A. E. Housman? The poem itself is a very good poem.
I'm gonna write that down.
Paragraph where the he died old thing comes from. There was a king that reigned. There was a king reigned in the east. That's about Mithridates. But the A Shropshire Lad is a great poem.
Maybe we'll read some poetry on part two.
Do you want to read A Shropshire Lad?
It's a good poem. Okay.
It's a good poem. Okay. Yeah.
Well, Matt, it's been fun. Part one. It's exceeded my expectations so far. Yeah. And I was pretty excited to read it.
Yeah, I know. This is a reread for me, but it's been long enough that I'm a lot of it's new. I'm enjoying it. So, hey, question. Are you, because every time we do something like this, we did when we did Xenophon and I, Claudia, so I was like, I don't know anything about this. After you're done with this, are you going to stop doing that?
And maybe no.
On to like, okay. Doing
my thing.
I
like this more. I like this a lot more than Xenophon, just like the pure text of that.
It's an easier read.
Yeah.
Sure. But I'm just curious when it becomes like, oh, this is like a minor hobby of mine. When does it become, that's my thing too? Like, oh, I'm into that a little bit. I've read 3 or 4 things and I like it.
I would have to become more immersed in it, right? I still get like, I'm still like, when are we? Like,
you still think they don't know how to wash their hands.
Yeah, I'm still in like, how do operations work? How are we moving foods and materials here? That's where I'm at. It's fun though. So that's part one. Coming up on the podcast, over on our Patreon, we'll have shortly our Thriller Corner back up there as we discuss Nine Tailors, which is from the classic age, golden age of thrillers, British, mystery.
British mystery.
Not what I was expecting. It's a little bit more complex.
We get really in depth on bell ringing.
A lot of bells over there. And then on the our main channel here, we'll probably have breakfast at Tiffany's soon. Yeah. Kind of going through our older stuff on our TBR. So a lot of good books we'll be discussing in the next week and months. And we'll have part two of The Poison King in the probably next couple weeks in. Hopefully not too long. So that's what's coming up, Matt. Anything I forgot to mention about our fun little podcast we do up there? All right.
Nine Tailors, Breakfast at Tiffany's, book and the movie. I'm gonna watch the movie. I've never seen the movie.
I know.
Yeah. So
listen, I'm gonna listen to the song a couple times.
Yeah, that'll be stuck in my head the whole time. I get little random bits of titles and stuff, so that'll be fun.
Thanks as always for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.
Bye.